Good morning. I call this committee meeting of State Government Finance and Policy to order on April 9th, 2026. There is a quorum present. We have a member participating remotely in accordance with House Rules 1005. That is Representative Katie Jones. First, we will move there is a quorum present, so we'll move the approval of the minutes for April 7th, 2026. Co-Chair Nash, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I move the adoption of the rules, or the minutes.
Of the minutes. We have a motion to adopt. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The minutes are approved. Now we will have an informal hearing on House File 4364. Welcome, Representative Jordan. This bill has to do with the Council on Central and Eastern European Affairs. I understand that we have two people here to testify, but if you would like to tell us about your bill. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair Cuivre, Chair Nash, and members of the committee. Good morning. This is a bill that would establish a Eastern and Central European Ethnic Council in the state of Minnesota. This is a bill that was brought to me by my constituents. As many of you know, because I never shut up about it, Northeast Minneapolis is the greatest place on earth. But it's one of the reasons why is that it is home to many Minnesotans who are descendants of Central and Eastern Europeans. We're famous for Comarche's Deli. We're famous for our Ukrainian Heritage Center. If you go to Northeast Minneapolis, you'll see many flags from across Eastern and Central Europe. We have many churches and other civic organizations that pertain to this area. But this is also a community with over 400,000 Minnesotans. So as proud as invisible as I am of my community, I am sure this is also your community as well. I'm confident that this is a bill that will help all of our communities. So this bill does establish an ethnic council modeled after our other three ethnic councils. That's also where we got the figure amount for this bill. Subdivision 1 is I find bills often hard to read, but this one's very easy to read for how the council is established and what the purpose of it is. And so it's, you know, to work with this community, work with our refugees and people fleeing war, displacement, or political upheaval, and talk about barriers to accessing government programs. The one thing I will say is that these countries are very diverse, and Minnesotans of Central and Eastern European ancestry have needs that reflect that diversity. And so establishing this ethnic council will better facilitate their inclusion in Minnesota. And with that, Madam Chair, I have some amazing testifiers with me, and I would love to turn it over to them.
When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please, and welcome.
Thank you. My name is Mikola Magitz. And dear Chair Cleverne, Chair Nash, and member of this respectful committee. Good morning. My name, again, is Mikola Magitz. I'm the coalition lead of this initiative and a proud member of Central and Eastern European communities and proud of Ukrainian heritage being myself. Today, on the behalf of over 20 community organizations and businesses representing region of Central and Eastern Europe of Minnesota, I ask for your support in creating this council. Our communities near 450,000 strong represents a vibrant part of Minnesota identity. We are entrepreneurs, educators, healthcare workers, students, artists, refugees, and citizens of Minnesota and the United States. From Polish and Ukrainians to Czech, Romanian, Croatian, Latvian, Lithuanians, and many others, I'm sure some of you even related to those heritages as well, respectable members of this committee. We have contributed deeply to Minnesota's civic and economic life for over 150 years. It's a lot, 150 years. This is we proudly contributing to the success and the life and diversity and economic development of the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, yet, our voices remain underrepresented in the state policymaking. We currently lack a formal structure to effectively engage with other ethnic councils. Existing ethnic councils like Latino Affairs, African Heritage, Asian Pacifics have proven that this model works, and our communities deserve the same seat at the table with other ethnic councils. If this council is established by you, we will support workforce development and immigrant entrepreneurship. We will promote culture understanding in public services. We will work on building safety and trauma-informed services for refugees. And there's a lot of refugees. You probably recall Balkan Wars, current Ukrainian wars. Minnesota welcomed thousands and thousands of refugees from Ukraine, and they need special care, and especially moving them from a welfare to workforce of Minnesota. And we are asking for your establishing of this council exactly for these reasons. The initiative, we initially asked for $700,000 annual budget, what is consistent with other ethnic councils. It's modest, but impact will be great. A stronger, more inclusive Minnesota for all. On behalf of those 20 community organizations and businesses and 450 ethnic representatives of Central and Eastern Europe, today we ask you to support this legislation. Thank you for your time and for leadership and for consideration. Thank you, Representative Jordan, for supporting this bill and endorsing it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dr. Magetz. And next we have Julia Miller. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Julia Miller. Good morning, Chair and members of this respectful committee. My name is Julia Miller, and I work in the public sector in workforce development, and I've been actively engaged in civic and advisory efforts across Minnesota. I'm a new American from Albania, and I have proudly called Minnesota home for the past 20 years. I'm here today to express my support for establishing a Council on Central and Eastern European Affairs. Minnesota is home to a growing Central and Eastern European community, as Mikolai mentioned, and this community contributes across our workforce, small businesses, and local communities. As our state continues to grow, it becomes increasingly important that we have a clear and consistent way to stay connected to the people who are a part of that growth. This council would offer a practical and structured way to do that. It creates a channel for communication, helping the state to better understand the needs of our community perspectives, while also helping individuals who are part of our community, over 450,000 members, as Mikolai mentioned, to better navigate public systems and opportunities that this great state offers. From a workforce perspective, this is about helping our community members to more fully connect their skills and experiences to opportunities in our state. Many individuals from Central and Eastern Europe bring strong education, strong technical skills, and entrepreneurial experience. When we strengthen connection between people and systems, we make it easier for that talent to meaningfully contribute to Minnesota's economy. This proposal builds on a model, as Mikolai mentioned, that already exists in our state, advisory councils that provide insight and support to make informed decisions. It is a modest structure designed to improve communication, strengthen engagement, and ensure that this connection continues as our communities grow. Ultimately, this is about ensuring that our systems remain responsive, our workforce remains strong, and our communities feel connected and supported. Thank you for your time and consideration, and thank you for your support for this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. And I do not have any other testifiers who signed up in advance. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll move to member discussion. Members, are there any questions or discussions for Representative Jordan? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan, other than I disagree with you on the best place on the planet, but thank you for bringing this.
Co-Chair Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Jordan, I'm going to echo that as well. If you come out to Carver County, you may find some better places, but I have met with both the testifiers in my office, recognize that Central and Eastern Europeans have made a great contribution to our state. The bill just didn't make deadline and didn't have the ability to have any funds for it. So, recognize the contribution and have worked with Representative Jordan on other issues, particularly regarding Ukraine. But have yet, as you saw in my office, Albania is one of the few European countries that I have not made it to. Because when I was in Europe for school, they wouldn't let us in. So, that's still a place I'd like to go. But it's a great conversation to continue having as we move forward to recognize the contribution. And Slava Ukraini.
Heroyam Slava.
Thank you very much. And I would just also like to extend my gratitude for your bringing the bill forward. Plymouth is the home to many Central and Eastern Europeans. And as their representative, I would be more than happy to support this legislation. And I always say, until we go signy die, anything is possible. So with that, I thank you. And we appreciate your being here and starting this really important conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next, we will have House File 4543, Representative Frazier. Representative Frazier, since you're not a member of the committee, I will move that House File 4543 be before the committee and be re-referred to Ways and Means. I understand you have a DE1.
That is correct, Madam Chair.
Right, I'll move the DE1. If you would please speak. Oh, sorry, I forgot. We changed the motion. We're going to lay it over. All right, thank you. So House File 4543. Is up for consideration. Will you please explain the DE1?
The DE makes some technical corrections, and it also allows to provide an option for local governments that have a prevailing wage ordinance to opt into this program that I'll speak about shortly.
Okay. Members, is there any discussion to the DE1? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the DE1, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The DE1 is adopted. To-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Nash and members of the committee. Thank you for the time here this morning. I'm here today to present House File 4543, a bill focused on bringing greater efficiency, accountability, transparency, and integrity to how we oversee projects funded with Minnesota taxpayer dollars. Under current Minnesota law, contractors and subcontractors on projects funded in whole or in part by the state of Minnesota are already required to submit certified payroll reports. Those reports are then collected and maintained by project owners, which include state agencies, local governments, school districts, and other organizations receiving state funds through bonding projects. Economic development grants and infrastructure investments such as lead service line replacement projects across our state. House File 4543 does not create any new reporting mandate. It does not expand prevailing wage law. It does not require contractors to submit new information beyond what is already required today. And it does not change what records are available to the public under Minnesota law. What this bill does is modernize the process. House File 4543 directs the Commissioner of Administration to establish a centralized electronic certified payroll reporting portal, a single secure platform where contractors can submit those reports in one place, rather than through fragmented and inconsistent systems across multiple jurisdictions. That change matters because right now, project owners bear the burden of collecting biweekly payroll reports throughout the life of a project, retaining those records for years after completion, and responding individually to data requests. This portal relieves that administrative burden, creates consistency across agency and makes compliance more efficient for everyone involved. It also strengthens oversight. Certified payroll reporting is one of the most effective tools we have to protect public dollars by preventing wage theft, worker misclassification, tax fraud, and insurance fraud on publicly funded projects. In addition, this bill gives local governments the option to opt into the portal for non-state funded projects. That means cities with prevailing wage ordinances or labor standards policies like Richfield, Bloomington, Brooklyn Park, and Grand Rapids can also benefit from these efficiencies if they choose to. Minnesota would not be alone in taking this step. Illinois, New Jersey, and most recently New York have already implemented similar systems, and this proposal allows us to build on lessons learned from those states while tailoring the system to Minnesota's existing laws and data practices. Members, this is a practical modernization measure rooted in good government. I am encouraged by the productive conversations happening among stakeholders, and I believe we are close to resolving any remaining concerns, which you'll hear about during testimony, but I believe we will be closely ready to resolve those, which is why we're laying the bill over, but I'm looking forward to getting it done this year. Thank you for your time and looking forward to discussion.
Thank you very much. And then we have four individuals who have signed up to testify. We'll begin with Nathan Jessen, followed by Joel Hansen. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Chair Clevorn, Chair Nash, members of the committee, my name is Nathan Jessen. I represent the Minnesota Inter-County Association. MICA is a group of 17 counties throughout the state representing suburban and regional centers. Here to just give the county perspective on this bill. Over the last few years, counties have been, in particular, dealing with a significant increase in data practice requests. A couple examples, Wright County in 2023 had 288. By 2025, that increased to 534. In Crow Wing County in 23, they had 63 requests. That's 228 in 2025 and even on pace for more this year. So as noted, the bill would create the centralized reporting system for state projects with prevailing wage requirements. So data practice requests about these requirements would go through that database rather than through the individual county. When I spoke with county officials about this legislation, they saw this as a small step to make their lives a little bit easier in providing a little bit of mandate relief. We also appreciate the DE amendment, which incorporates some technical feedback from the counties. It's not going to turn around that rapid increase that I was talking about from those counties, but we do think it's a small and smart step worth taking. So thank you for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much. And next we'll have Joel Hansen, followed by Bradley Peterson. Please state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Joel Hansen. I am the Director of Government Relations with Associated Builders and Contractors. We're a construction industry trade group with over 365 members across the state that employ over 23,000 men and women in the construction industry. And so, our concerns with the bill, I just want to start by saying we do support the streamlining process of prevailing wage reporting. However, our concerns are specific as it pertains to protecting employee data. And so on lines 1.3 through 1.14 of the bill, it establishes the portal, which is gleaning information from certified payroll forms. If you were to look at the DLI certified payroll form, it has employee name, address, days worked, pay rate, hours worked on particular days. And currently, as has already been said through testimony, that is retrieved from an individual in the public through a data practices request. We have concerns that this portal would be public facing and upset that process. And so, that's sensitive data that we don't want to have exposed to the public. And as an example, currently on the DLI website, you can find licensed trade information. There's at least one member of this legislative body that I'm aware of that has their information, their home address, their home phone number that is publicly available right now. And so considering that that's where we're at and we're looking at expanding this, we just really want to have protections in place for your constituents that are going to be out in the field working. And secondarily, I would just say that there's other groups that have expressed these concerns. The Minnesota Chapter of the National Association of Minority Contractors, Minnesota Minority Goods and Services, Minnesota Chamber, the Electrical Association, who has a a letter in your packets, as well as the Minnesota Plumbing, Heating, and Cooling Contractors Association. So really appreciate the ability that we've had to work with the stakeholders. We've met with the Department of Labor and Industry yesterday, as well as the proponents of the bill. So I think we are working towards maybe some sort of compromise, but we're just not there yet, and we just want to see the protections of employee data maintained. So thank you very thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate hearing from you. Mr. Peterson, when you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, and then you will be followed by Laura Ziegler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Co-Chair Nash. My name is Bradley Peterson with the firm of Flaherty & Hood, here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. CGMC represents over 100 cities outside of the seven-county metro area, and we are happy to speak in support of House File 4543. As you know, cities of all sizes across the state engage in all sorts of construction projects that are covered by the state's prevailing wage laws. The range of these projects includes water and wastewater treatment plants, public safety buildings, libraries, and other public buildings, and most recently, lead pipe removal and replacement. As such, CGMC supports this bill for a number of reasons. First off, a centralized payroll reporting system would relieve local governments of their maintenance of records responsibilities. Secondly, as Mr. Jessen noted, one of the banes of existence for many local government employees are data practice requests. These are increasing over time, and we get a lot of feedback from our cities of, isn't there something that we can do to relieve the burden at least a little bit on some of these requests? And then finally, Subdivision 6, as Representative Frazier noted, would allow those local governments that have their own local prevailing wage ordinances or labor standards to opt into the system. There are a number of greater Minnesota cities that have their own prevailing wage ordinances, especially in northern Minnesota, that could take advantage of this provision. In conclusion, as an advocate for local governments, I'm often asked what the state can do to relieve cities from state-imposed mandates and regulations. While creation of this reporting portal may not be the biggest thing the legislature could do, it does seem like it's one of the simplest things that they could do this year. Therefore, we urge favorable action on this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Absolutely. And now we will have Laura Ziegler. When you're ready, if you'll state your name for the record and begin your testimony, please.
Chairs Cleborn and Nash, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today on House File 4543. My name is Laura Ziegler. I'm here on behalf of the 350 general and specialty contractors that make up Associated General Contractors of Minnesota. AGC is not opposed to the intent of the bill. However, we are actively working on key implementation issues that should be addressed for this to function effectively in the construction industry. So I'd like to highlight four key considerations that we would like to see addressed. First, avoiding duplication. Many contractors already use established payroll systems to meet current requirements, so it's really important to us that we're not creating a second parallel reporting process that would require that duplicative nature manual data entry. Second, interoperability. The system must be able to integrate with existing contractor software. Without that, it does risk that increasing administrative burden rather than the intent, which is to improve efficiency and streamlining the process. Third, which you've already heard about with respect to data privacy and security, the bill puts detailed payroll information at anyone's fingertips rather than going through a data practices request. So we want to ensure that the appropriate safeguards are in place so that sensitive worker information, particularly their name, tied to specific job sites or their home address, is protected and not subject to misuse. And finally, and this one's really important to us, but may not be outlined exactly in the statute, but implementation and stakeholder engagement. This is going to be critical. Unfortunately, in the other states where this has been rolled out, it has not gone smoothly, and we need to ensure that the HR professionals and the administrators that we represent, they're going to be the ones using the system every week, really, on every prevailing wage project. So it's essential that the state works closely with contractors, software providers, and project owners to design a system that is functional and efficient. So to reiterate, we would like to see avoiding duplication, ensuring that interoperability and data security. I want to thank Representative Frazier for his engagement. I'm available for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll move to member discussion. Any discussion from the members? Representative Bonner, Co-Chair Bonner.
Vice Chair. Thank you. I just wanted to mention here, there was one thing that did send up a little bit of a red flag for me, and I know that you're working on it, so, but I do just want to suggest that in particular under subdivision 2, when we're talking about making things available to the public, there is included in this list some sensitive data. And as it's been alluded to by several of the testifiers, one of the things that I have been talking about a lot lately is pushing our state systems to reconsider what information we make public and what we don't. And specifically, what we should always be striving for is the minimum data necessary, right? If we put it out into the world, then anyone can use it, scrape it. It could end up in a large language model. It could end up being used for all kinds of interesting purposes or be traced back to individuals with potential harmful consequences. So my only ask for you is that we very carefully consider whether or not all of the data that's listed here needs to be listed as public, or if it could be listed as private but subject to data requests if necessary. I just want to be very, very careful about what we're putting out into the public sphere. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, any comment?
Yes, Madam Chair. Representative Bonner, thank you for that. As you can imagine, we're all very sensitive to particular data that may be out there for individuals in particularly. That is something that's top of mind for me. That's why we're continuing to have these conversations. I think we're going to figure out ways to address that.
Thank you. Representative Bonner, any follow-up? Okay. Representative Lugar-Nicolai.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks, Representative Frazier, for this. I think that it is obviously very important that we ensure that, employee data is private to the extent necessary and required by law, and it doesn't look like this modifies anything with respect to the Data Practices Act in that regard. I do also, though, I note that the removal of the categories of data in the original, the underlying bill did, is clear, I think, in the DE1, and then hopefully we'll still collect that data for the purposes of ensuring that we can enforce our wage theft and misclassification laws.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Representative. That is the intent.
Did you have a follow-up? No? Okay. Representative Sexton.
Thank you, Chair. We really didn't talk about the fiscal note, and my observation in general is we already have a significant backlog of antiquated software that we should be prioritizing for, upgrades and fixes to help our counties and local governments. So I'm very concerned that we're stepping off into a new area without prioritizing what we keep screaming about needs to be fixed that's in existence today.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Sexton, for the comment. I think we can do both. As we're looking at this to have the conversations to clear up some of the concerns that are out there, we can also look at how we can integrate it into the system upgrades that we need to do as well.
Representative Sexton, any comment? Okay. Any further? Oh, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Frazier. I think this directionally is excellent. And to have ways that we can do things more efficiently to reduce the burdens on local governments for data practices requests. This kind of thing strikes me as a way to proactively eliminate opportunities for fraud in the system. So I appreciate that. What were your thoughts on the comments made about implementation and relative to what's happened in other states, and how can we make sure, if and when we do this, that we learn from that?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Kraft, for the question. Yeah, many of the conversations that I've had with stakeholders, you heard the concerns here. It was they were given examples of what's happening in other states, and particularly, I think, New Jersey. I think we can take a look at those. I mean, I've had mentors in my life that always tell me, learn from the mistakes that I've done so you don't repeat them. So we can look at those mistakes and make sure we don't repeat those.
Any follow-up, Representative Kraft? Co-Chair Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been talking with both sides of this issue for the last 2 weeks, I think, I'm glad that we're not moving this forward because there are still concerns that have to get addressed. And, you know, I think until that happens, I don't feel comfortable in moving this out of committee. I think that there's merits to the idea, but there really has to be greater adoption within both sides of this issue. And would just encourage you to keep talking. No promises, but I think that it's important that both sides feel comfortable with this. And having spoken to both of them a number of times, actually, you walked by me the other day. Just yesterday, I was on the phone with one of the folks who were concerned about this. So I think it's just important to keep the dialogue open. But I'm glad that we're holding this over. So thanks.
Representative Frazier, comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, just to that, thank you, Chair Nash. I wholeheartedly agree. I think the concerns that have been raised are appropriate, and we'll take the time that we need to discuss those and get to a place we can all agree on.
Thank you. And then I will close by saying I'm really supportive of the legislation. I think it's important, and I think it helps people. And I think it's also a very complementary to the work that we're seeing Representative Scott doing for subcontractors as well. So I do hope that you're able to get some consensus and we could maybe move it out next week or something. All right. Thank you so much. Any closing remarks?
Just that I've seen this from the perspective of someone has to respond to data requests. I've served on local city council in a smaller city, and I've also worked in a large school district that gets many data requests. So anytime we can streamline how we respond to these and take that administrative burden off, it is helpful for those local jurisdictions. So I'm looking forward to moving this forward. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you very much, and we appreciate your being here. And with that, this bill is laid over as amended.
Thank you, Chair Cleavorne, and welcome to the table. We're going to bring before us, we have House File 4821 up for consideration. I'm going to move that House File 4821 be re-referred to the General Register. And now that we have the bill before us, I don't see any amendments. Chair Cleavorne, would you like to speak to your bill?
Thank you very much, and I'm just looking for my quick notes here. The bill itself is pretty simple, and I have with me experts who can answer your technical questions if you have them later. House File 4821 is what I call the penny problem, and also it deals with a small issue of high deductible insurance plans. So first to the penny problem. In February of 2025, President Trump ordered that the U.S. Treasury Department cease production of the penny. The penny supply shortage has accelerated very quickly, and state agencies are beginning to report that with cash transactions, they are either out or near the end of their penny supply, and banking partners are unable to supply additional pennies. There is no federal regulation on rounding rules. And retailers and retailers and other private entities have implemented rounding rules. But without specific legal authority, state agencies may not accept or provide anything other than exact amounts when entering into cash transactions. This section authorizes agencies to round cash transactions. And so that's what the first section of the bill does. In the second section of the bill, the high deductible insurance plans, currently law requires MMB to offer high deductible health plans. Pairing a high deductible plan with a well-funded health savings account does provide marginal benefits to workers. However, what we have experienced is that of the 131,000 total members that use healthcare plans, only 89 employees are currently enrolled in the two compensation plans that require a high deductible option. This bill would provide a small savings on the administration cost by changing must to may. And that's what the second part of the bill does. And with that, I would ask that we move to member discussion and our experts can answer questions if needed.
All right. We will then open up to member questions. Representative Joy.
Thank you. Chair Cleburne, so I guess I'm this one's kind of interesting to me.
Yeah.
You know, I'm familiar with the rounding and rounding down. In the state agency, and the experts probably can answer, what do we take? Like, what order do we take, see a lot of cash, and are we seeing cash in what part of the department? Or?
Chair, if Mr. Moore could please answer that question, that would be great.
Mr. Moore?
Thank you very much. My name is Paul Moore, Assistant Commissioner of Accounting Services at Minnesota Management and Budget, and I oversee accounting and treasury operations for the state government enterprise. Cash transactions are pretty pervasive across state agencies. When I surveyed state agencies this fall, I was actually surprised at the number. Many state agencies engage in small number of cash transactions, and that's dwindling. However, as you know, there are a few where cash transactions are more prevalent. Department of Public Safety, Driver and Vehicle Services, and of course, deputy registrars as well, who engage in transactions authorized on behalf of the state. Department of Natural Resources as well, through hunting, fishing licenses, state park passes, gift shops as well, and the DNR, like the Driver and Vehicle Services and DPS, also has deputy registrars who engage in their transactions. Department of Revenue is another one. Taxpayers can settle their tax liabilities in person with the Department of Revenue. And then here at Minnesota Management and Budget as well, we issue state warrants. Think of those as the state checks, and we are the one place in the state someone is guaranteed to be able to cash their warrant if they have a problem doing so with a local bank.
Representative Joy.
Thank you. And one other question I have is, now with the cannabis tax coming due soon, which I know there's only seven banks right now in Minnesota, that's going to be handled, I think, possibly, and you guys probably can answer this, with ACH, or is that paid with cash since it's not federally recognized? And what will that look like?
Assistant Commissioner Moore.
Thank you, Chair Bonner. Representative, as I understand it, those transactions are collected by, or will be, by the Department of Revenue. I can't speak to where they are in the planning process. I've been in meetings with them and the state's banking partners as well as workarounds, because federally chartered banks, as you know, regulations regarding the collection of cannabis related revenue, but can't speak to the specifics. My apologies.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jay. Next on the list, we have Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the issue I have is it should be written more clearly in that on 119. Mm-hmm. And 120, instead of notwithstanding and then saying that 1 and 2 cents, the cleanest way to do it is on 113, remove the 1 and 2 cents, and on 116, add the 1 and 2 cents. That way I dislike, those notwithstandings that could easily be fixed.
Chair Cleburne.
Do you have a comment about the drafting?
Assistant Commissioner Moore.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Quam. The intent of lines 119 and 120 is that for anyone who has a transaction totaling 5 cents, whether it's they're owed a refund the transaction, if there's a total transaction amount of 1 or 2 cents, so whether they are entitled to a state warrant of one or two cents, which happens more frequently than one might expect, or if they have just any sort of transaction with the state government, that would not round to zero.
Thank you, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If you actually read the verbiage, you define in 113 transactions that round down. And effectively, the 119, 120 would erase the 1 and 2 cents out of there. And you're saying it would round up. Therefore, you've already got in clause one, where you define which ones are round up. And, you know, the less ambiguous, the habit should be writing it most clearly and not have anything more than absolutely needed in a notwithstanding clause. But, if the author could, in a later point, actually do the correction to make it more appropriate.
Thank you. Chair Cleaborne.
Representative Quam, I had to read this language myself multiple times to understand the difference. So in line 113, I totally get where you're coming from. So in line 113, it's an amount of the total transaction. So if I'm buying something that costs $5.01, I can round down. Now, in line 119, and I totally get where you're coming from, I had to read this so many times. It says basically, if it's you owe 1 penny or you owe 2 cents, you have to pay something. So now you have to pay a nickel.
Representative Quam. Okay. All right.
I totally get the confusion because I had to read that so many times going, wait a minute, what does this actually mean? And that's what I finally rested on.
All right. Clear as mud. Okay. Anyone else with questions? Representative Nash, or Chair Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for legislative watchdogs out there, the reference is for this to go, I think we said to the General Register, but just to level set for everybody, having gone past our deadline, we had a little vacation that was nice, means that this didn't hit deadline, but what will happen is programmatically it'll get caught by the chief clerk's office, and it will go automatically to the rules committee where it will be considered for a potential rules waiver. So I've gotten a couple texts already. This is not going directly to the General Register. It's going to have to go to rules, but that will not be the reference. It'll just be done programmatically. Just wanted to level set that, and Chair Cleaborne and I have talked about that. So
that's correct.
Any bill that we move out today, if we move it out, would have the same outcome.
But it's important that we hear it in committee so that everyone has a chance to have their questions answered.
All right. Thank you for that. Any other questions? All right. Chair Cleaborne, would you like to close your bill?
Thank you, members, for the discussion today. It's a really important bill, especially for our deputy registrars. They have to have some way to deal with cash transactions. And so I ask for your support wherever this whenever we can get this out of rules. So thank you so much.
All right. Hearing no further discussion, I'm going to renew my motion for House File 4821 to be re-referred to Ways and Means. The General Register. My apologies. We switched that up. Just for the record, we are re-referring House File 4821 to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, the ayes have it, and House File 4821 is re-referred to the General Register.
Madam Chair, I have one more item I would like to take care of before we trade places. I would like to bring House File 3461, which was the leave for legislative service, back before the body. And I would ask, we've already discussed the bill. This is a conformity bill that allows legislators who take legislative leave from the executive branch to serve in the House or in the legislative service to be to receive the same benefits they would if they worked for a county, and it just brings state conformity. This is Representative Meg Lugar-Nicolai's bill, but I would also like to refer it to the General Register after having had conversations with Co-Chair Nash.
Okay. With that, I'm going to move that we reconsider House File 3461. So I'm going to move that House File 3461 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
And the ayes have it. House File 3461 has been re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you. Representative, when you're ready, we are having an informational hearing on the governor's budget, supplemental budget request. This is an informational hearing.
Yes.
I understand that we have two people here to help with questions and answers. So that would be Assistant Commissioner Paul Moore and Assistant Commissioner Martha Burton from Revenue.
Yes. And if they would so desire, I'd encourage Assistant Commissioner Moore and Assistant Commissioner Burton to come on up for the interest of time, so they're ready to roll. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right, I'm going to sort of briefly high level walk you through some of the provisions in the bill. And then we have the two commissioners, assistant commissioners here to give some additional background and a little color. And then, of course, we do have some additional folks here from the agencies if there are questions from the members of the committee. With that, Madam Chair, I would like to start with the MMB provisions and specifically the internal controls, internal audit staff sections. In this specific item, the governor has proposed a comprehensive legislative package aimed at preventing, detecting, investigating, and holding accountable those who commit fraud in Minnesota state programs. Any amount of fraud is too much. And in Minnesota, we meet that with zero tolerance. One of the proposed aims is to increase oversight of state government internal controls. It provides 15 FTEs for statewide internal control specialists and internal auditors with MMB. The staffing capacity will allow MMB to take a more active role with state agencies to design and implement corrective action plans and other internal control improvements within their operations, including the implementation of OLA audit recommendations. It will also allow MMB to deploy internal auditors to test the operating effectiveness of these corrective actions. The Director of Program Integrity, Tim O'Malley, recently released a program integrity roadmap. Pillar 19 of that roadmap contains a consistent recommendation to expand MMB's oversight and verification capacity, including auditors. This work has also been discussed in this committee recently, and we, as we heard in House File 3642, which addressed the OLA audit recommendations and provides additional direction to MMB to assist agencies in their implementation of OLA recommendations. In Article 2, Section 5, the penny shortage, We actually just covered some of this in the previous bill with Chair Cleburne. But in essence, the federal government stopped minting new pennies in November of 2025, and the Federal Reserve stated it would continue to recirculate pennies as long as it could possibly could. However, this supply shortage has accelerated much faster than anticipated, and state agencies are beginning to report they are either out or near the end of their supply, and that our banking partners are unable to supply additional pennies. There are no federal regulations on rounding rules, and statements from the U.S. Treasury have noted states will approach these issues differently based on unique considerations. Retailers and other private entities have implemented rounding rules for cash transactions on an individual basis. However, without specific legal authority, state agencies may not accept or provide anything other than exact amounts when entering into cash transactions. This proposal would authorize agencies to round cash transactions as provided by the framework in the bill. The authorization would be extended to entities that engage in cash transactions on behalf of the state, such as deputy registrars. As the bill makes clear, rounding would be applied to only to cash transactions and not other forms of payment. The bill also requires that rounding policies be posted at locations where the cash transactions occur. And then for MMB Article 2, Section 13, there's an option to not provide high deductible health plans, as just discussed in the last bill as well. And we do have a Director Benchouf here to speak to any questions on that section. But current law requires MMB to offer high deductible health plans, as discussed earlier. This would allow the option to not provide separate high deductible plans for those employees by changing the must to a may, as we discussed earlier. Out of over 131,000 total members, there are only 264 enrolled in CGIP's high deductible plans, and this only applies to 89 of those individuals. The bill proposes to give MMB the opportunity for additional efficiencies in administering CGIP. We're going to move on to the Department of Administration provisions, which strengthen state contracts and grants and expand the responsible contract law. Sections 7 through 12 work together to enhance state agencies' ability to combat fraud and proactively remove bad actors from participating in state grant and procurement processes. You might note we have also heard some of these provisions in other bills before this committee. The section modifies provisions in both the grant statute, Chapter 16B, and procurement statute 16C to remove eligibility of the recipient does not, or if the recipient does not meet the responsibility provisions defined in Section 10, on lines 10.3 through 10.25. The provisions include many critical elements. Among them, the entity is not currently suspended or disbarred, and that none of its owners, officers, directors, managers, or controlling parties have a conviction of a felony financial crime that has occurred within the last 3 years. The responsibility provisions outlined extend to subcontractors and recipients, as noted in lines 323 to 325. Of note, Section 8, the term related entity is now defined. This is in conjunction with the use of the terms on line 10.13 and 10.16 and 10.17, expands the reach of agencies to protect against bad actors that attempt to get around state requirements by setting up new successor organizations under a different name or other types of restructuring to continue their nefarious practices. Section 12, lines 11.23 to 11.26, provides ramifications for false statements of compliance, including ineligibility or termination of a contract, as well as subject the entity to suspension and disbarment from receiving state contracts and grants. These changes, along with others, work the agencies are doing, allows for us to coordinate, collaborate, share data, and internal control enhancements will go a long way in providing the tools and legal support the agencies need as they continue the critical work to protect taxpayer dollars. We also have sections that work on prohibiting legislatively named grants. Section 6 implements a recommendation from the OLA and the state agency's OIG Coordinating Council to end naming grantees in appropriations. The changes would ensure that all state-funded grants be administered through a competitive process, would also eliminate potential conflicts of interest that could exist between legislators and grantees, and grants from appropriations from the Environmental and Natural Resources Trust Fund, Legacy Fund, and capital grants from general obligation bonds would be exempt from this requirement, as well as grants to tribes and political subdivisions would also be exempt. I'm going to move on to the Department of Revenue sections. Article 1, Section 5, the fraud prevention and enforcement capacity. First, it appropriates $1.839 million in fiscal year 27 and $2.786 million in fiscal year 28 and $2.725 million in fiscal year 29 to bolster revenues fraud prevention and enhancement capacity through staffing and internal control improvements. This will strengthen revenue's ability to prevent, detect, and prosecute tax fraud, protect taxpayer dollars, and uphold a fair and accountable tax system. It responds to an increase in operational demands in recent years as well. In the 6 months since governors executed orders 2510, the Revenue's Criminal Investigation Division has reviewed an additional 239 referrals for suspected tax fraud. Public engagement with Revenue's fraud tip line has doubled in the last 5 years from an average of 755 tips to now 1,432 tips annually. This requires additional investigative workload and timely action. As we're committed to protecting taxpayer dollars since 2022, having prevented 1,117,119 fraudulent returns from being processed, that division has also stopped $270 million in fraudulently filed refunds and collected nearly $2 billion through non-compliant activities. Finally, we'll move on to the AG provisions. On lines 2.1, it increases the funding for the state's Medicare Fraud Control Unit, adding $1.231 million in fiscal year 27 and ongoing. The money is for an additional 18 new staff members to the Attorney General's Office of Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, or MFCU, to account for almost tripling of the number of fraud referrals to MFCU that they have received. The bill will increase MFCU staff from 32 to 50. With those funds, MFCU would add 11 investigators, 3 attorneys, and 4 support staff for the unit. The Medical Fraud Control Unit is a unit within the Attorney General's office that investigates and prosecutes Medicaid provider fraud. Similar units exist in all 50 states across the country and are generally located within the Attorney General's office. 75% of the unit's funding comes from the federal government grants and the other 25% from state grants. And we know we have an increased desire to have oversight over all of those funds. MFCU staffing levels are based on the size of the state's Medicaid budget. The present size of Minnesota's MFCU 32 was set when the state's Medicaid budget was roughly $13 billion, excuse me. Now that the Medicaid budget is almost $20 billion, HHS OIG recommends Minnesota's MFCU increase its staffing levels as appropriate for proper oversight. And with that, I do have 2 testifiers here to speak specifically. I have Assistant Commissioner Moore from MMB and Assistant Commissioner Burton from Revenue. We do also have folks from Admin and the AG's office here for questions.
Thank you very much, Vice Chair Bonner. I think we will move, if it's all right, to member questions, and then our experts can answer questions if that's appropriate. All right. Member discussion? No member discussion? Okay, then. Co-Chair Nash, would you like, and then I'll come to you, Representative Bonner. Yes. Oh, I am sorry. Representative Sexton, you had a question. I apologize.
Being on a former planning board and such, I find it interesting that we've got a building permit not required. I'm all about local authority. Is there a reason that we've got that snuck into this bill?
Can you speak to which section?
12.28.
And this might be a question for admin.
Hold on one moment while we bring admin up.
Okay, thank you so much. We are referencing lines 12.28 through 12.33 in the bill. If you could please state your name and address the question.
Certainly. Good morning, Chair Clevorn, Chair Nash, members. Representative Sexton, Section 14 is related to the 2023 BCA project that was appropriated. We generally work with the local jurisdictions to cooperate and respond to their requests. We had staff support for this. We got a little sideways in the variance process, and there's a portion of the fence which is outside of the variance process that was fine to proceed, and then there's a half of it which is not. So we're in this kind of weird, I guess, procedural posture right now that we can't complete the security fence. So we sought some legislative solution for it.
Thank you, but could you just please state your name for the record?
Oh,
thank
I apologize.
You. That's fine.
I'm Greg Ebug. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services for the Department of Administration.
Thank you. Representative Sexton, did you have a follow-up?
I do. I mean, it sounds like we're being used as a way to bypass the local government system. And I definitely do not support that. I'd like to see this removed from the bill.
Okay. Thank you very much. And a reminder to the committee, this is an informational hearing. So thank you so much. And your comments are noted, Representative Sexton. Any further discussion? Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bonner. A lot in here. I'll just comment that I don't really have a question, but there are things in here around that seem to be very practical kinds of things in terms of addressing some of the fraud challenges we have, both in MMB and admin, and putting resources in place to conduct the kinds of things that seem to be the things we need to do to really get ahead of this. So I appreciate that. There's a lot of discussion in it, but it seems like there's some kind of nitty-gritty stuff here that's really good stuff. So thank you.
Representative Bonner, do you have any statements?
Nothing to add to that, but I do agree that many of the provisions in here are fairly straightforward, very pragmatic.
Thank you so much. Any other member discussion? Representative Lugar-Nicolai.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Madam Vice Chair. I know that the prevailing winds are blowing pretty much in the direction of avoiding named grants, but I want to point out that we have gotten consistent nudging from Minnesota Council of Nonprofits on the concern that it isn't always a level playing field for differently situated nonprofits to be in the competitive grant application process. And so I hope that, I know this is an informational hearing, but that we think about how do we ensure that that is as open a process as possible if that's where we're going to land.
Representative Bonner.
I will say thank you, Representative Chair and Representative Lugar-Nicolai. I know that as that has been an ongoing debate here in the legislature, how we level that playing field, but also avoid any potential conflicts. And I would say under this provision that debate continues, and certainly we will see how this plays out as parts of this bill may be interpreted in other bills as well.
Representative Lugar-Nicolai, any other comments? Okay. Vice Chair or Co-Chair Nash. I'm calling everybody the wrong title this morning, so apologies. How about just Chair Nash?
Thank you. Never seen a more thorough presentation of the governor's suggested budget.
Thank you. And I would like to comment on the ending of named grants as well. We've spent the interim working with really dedicated nonprofits who have helped us. And we had a bill for it that we've moved out of committee to help us streamline the grant process and to making sure that there are no conflicts of interest and things like that. So I want to acknowledge that hard work of our nonprofit partners in making sure that we are doing clean grants, we are doing sustainable grants, we are doing legal grants, all of the good things around grants, because as we all know and we all agree on this committee, no amount of fraud is acceptable. So with that, I'm going to thank you for your presentation. Do you have any closing remarks?
None other than to say thank you for the time and opportunity to present the governor's supplemental budget. And hopefully we'll continue to have this conversation going forward.
Thank you very much. And then members, I believe with that, we have concluded all of our business for the day. And our next meeting, are you holding a meeting on Tuesday? Our next meeting will be next Tuesday. And with that, members, we are adjourned.